You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So yeah, thanks to Berkman for having us all, and to Lokman in particular for inviting me to present. I'm going to talk a little bit about political campaigns. My background is in communications, in sociology and political science, and I think my argument will reflect that. So we'll see to what extent it sort of broadcast well across the many different disciplines and interests present here. My approach to what I'm doing is primarily ethnographic. I find settings that interest me and find a way to sort of embed myself there, to use a term used earlier tonight, and then spend some months participating and observing what goes on there in practice, sort of listening to people, conducting focus groups afterwards and interviews and so on and so forth. People may have sort of differing degrees of familiarity with that approach. Elsewhere, I have written on that basis about news media, but tonight I'll be talking about some work I've done in two political campaigns. I did 10 months of field work in two congressional campaigns, two Democratic candidates running for Congress. I'd be happy to talk about the particulars of the case. Both were competitive districts, and both were rather well-funded campaigns. Expenditures north of $3 million in each district when you combine the candidate expenditures and support from the campaign committees. So that's about $10 per vote cast. So I think that's sort of a thing to keep in mind as you to listen to me talk and we should start to the discussion, is that this argument is deliberately not based on the Obama campaign. So if you're thinking that I'll be talking about the Obama campaign, you'll be sort of wrong in a sense. But it'd be interesting to talk about the differences between what I'm describing and analyzing and what you have heard about the Obama campaign or what you have experienced if you were involved in that in any sort of sense. I think one thing that has characterized a lot of research in the area I'm in, which is sort of the intersection between the study of old organizations, new technologies, and forms of participation, is that there is a lot of attention paid to very exceptional cases. So in politics, for instance, the Dean campaign, now the Obama campaign, previously Jesse Ventura's run for governor, or internationally, for instance, the Zapatista movement. Whereas I am deliberately focusing on very ordinary campaigns, some campaigns that are competitive and well-funded, but campaigns where I had no particular reason to believe in advance that they would be extraordinary in terms of the organizing practices or the technologies involved. A native speaker have gently nudged me to revise the title a little bit since the abstract was sent out. So currently the paper behind the presentation is called Mundane Internet Tools and Mobilizing Practices in U.S. Campaigns. And the question that I want to address is this. Given the much-wanted mobilizational potential of the internet in politics that both academics and professionals and elected officials talk about a lot, what internet tools are in practice most important for how people are actually mobilized to take part in political campaigns? And I focus here narrowly on electoral politics and participation defined as volunteering in a campaign. So that's sort of the scope of it. And my answer to the question is, in a way, sort of given away by the title I've chosen. I'll argue that when it comes to mobilizing people to take part in political campaigns, mundane internet tools like email and search are relatively more important than emerging tools like Facebook or YouTube, or specialized tools like campaign websites and various sorts of customer relationship management software adopted for political purposes. I've deliberately chosen to try to offer an empirical typology as an answer to the question instead of a laundry list of the sort of the most popular tools of the day. And the choices are motivated by the glacial speed at which academics like myself work. By the time that this comes out in any shareable form, apart from presentations like this, Twitter will be sort of an old hat, and so will Facebook probably. So I'm trying to find a level of abstraction that fits in between just sort of naming names and speaking these in possibly general terms as the internet and its impact on something. So I'm trying to find a level in between that makes sense, and I think that's probably where the meat of the discussion today will be, is the extent to which the typology I offer is useful. So that's really where I'd appreciate your feedback in particular. So the distinction that I'm offering is between mundane, emerging, and specialized tools. And I want to point out at the outset that this is meant to be a relative and empirical categorization. So that is that tools are mundane for someone at some point in some setting. So think by analogy, for instance, of cars as a relatively mundane tool. They're not mundane in the sense that I could build a car or that everyone has a car, but they're mundane in the sense that we know what a car is. Most of us intuitively know what a car is, what it does, what it can and what it can't do. And if you think then of the contrast to an emerging tool, think of the car when it was conceived by most people as a horseless carriage. That's the distinction I want to suggest between mundane and emerging tools. Sure, we can see that they exist. There are horseless carriages roaming the streets of London, you know, in the early 20th century, but they are less widespread and they do not come across as intuitively useful to everyone. So this is what I mean by relative, of course, here, is that many of the tools that I will talk about as emerging are very mundane to most of the people in this room, are very commonplace, well-known, intuitively useful, and so on and so forth. But those of you who have encountered, for instance, Esther Hargitay's work will know that even tools that by now for most of us are probably almost sort of old news may have name recognition in the low, you know, 10s or 15s%. So Twitter last year, when she did survey research at the University of Illinois, more than 70%, I believe, of the college students that she surveyed didn't even know what Twitter was. Specialized tools as a sort of the third category, if to sort of push the car analogy a little bit further, would be sort of the bobcats or the go-karts or the trucks. Even if they're sort of common, some of them are widespread, they're dedicated and specialized tools that are typically used by specialists and specialized organizations. So it's not like everyone who has a garden has a bobcat, though they sort of probably could use it for shoveling dirt around and whatnot. They're typically relatively more under the control of specialized organizations. And of sort of examples of internet tools that I would fit into this typology and that are important, potentially important, and sometimes used in mobilizing practices and political campaigns today would be, in the case of mundane tools, most notably email and search. It's sort of well known, they're still the killer apps. Emerging tools would be social networking sites and video and photo sharing sites that are certainly on the radar, but do not always have the same penetration rate as email and search. Rarely has penetration rates that even approximates that. And then specialized internet tools would be things like campaign websites and then various forms of online integrated software solutions, like, as mentioned, various forms of customer relationship management tools adopted for political uses, in the case of the Democratic Party, often to provide a vendor such as NGP, or voter databases that have been combined with targeting tools to facilitate field efforts, such as on the Democratic side, the Voter Activation Network tool, which is used to make voter information about voters available in the field offices, so canvassers and the like can target voters very precisely, sort of on the sort of on a real-time basis. So what makes me think that email is a more important part of mobilizing practice than the campaign websites that congressional campaigns routinely spend something like $20,000 on? Well, obviously, this is my field work, my research in the two campaigns that I spent 10 months with. I went there being very interested in internet tools and in emerging forms of political organizations, such as Move On and Democracy for America and other sort of Netroots type organizations. And what happened to me in those districts I spent some time in, one of them in Connecticut, where Ned Lamont was quite successful in mobilizing sort of a Netroot constituency in his Senate primary in 2006, was that, for instance, websites, I didn't really see anyone using websites, either in the campaign office or the volunteers I spoke to. And it was sort of puzzling. So I sat down with volunteer coordinators and online communication directors and asked about the roles of websites in mobilizing practice and mobilizing volunteers. And the answer from one volunteer coordinator is, I think, as intriguing as it was blunt. He said, quote, "I don't believe much in websites," end of quote. Okay, that's interesting. So in both campaigns, they had websites, and they had websites that were developed by brand name vendors in the political business, Blue State Digital and White Horse Strategies. So they're good companies. They're not some sort of low end products of some sort. And in both cases, they generated names of potential volunteers. The thing is that in practice, the organizers quickly realized that the people who signed up on the website were people who had already signed up or become involved in the campaigns through other means. So the typical succession would be that someone would show up at a meeting or walk into the campaign office and volunteer, and volunteer their personal information, then we'll get an email, and then they will sign up on the website. So there are a lot of duplicates in the names that were generated by the websites. And furthermore, in the actual the practical work of doing of mobilizing people, organizers spend a lot of time phoning people, trying to encourage them to volunteer. The people who do volunteer are encouraged to spend their time parsing their personal networks, their, you know, their whatever association they're members of, people who might be interested in volunteering. And in this work, the campaign websites play little or no role at all. Similarly with the sort of the customer relationship management like tools, these are very widely used in fundraising practices to track donors and to hit them at appropriate intervals for more money and whatnot. They're not used, basically not used, in mobilizing practices. Staffers primarily use ad hoc combinations of spreadsheets on their laptop, you know, whiteboards, post-its, sign-in sheets, emails sent to each other, Google documents and whatnot. They construct their own sort of ad hoc tool sets to interface with volunteers. They don't use these customer relationship management tools very much. And the same thing with the vote-up database tools or targeting tools like the VAN. Sometimes staffers do try to use them for mobilizing purposes. They try to, for instance, try to identify people who regularly vote in primaries as partisans who might be more inclined to volunteer than other people, and then call through those lists. And I can attest to, having done a fair amount of that work myself to sort of earn my right to be in the campaigns, that that is not a particularly effective way of mobilizing volunteers. The recruitment rate is very low. Most people turn you down or just slam down the phone. It's not a particularly, and it's not a particularly common practice either. It's sort of a last gap measure when you need another 10 volunteers for GOTV at the end of the campaign. So those are specialized tools. I was sort of puzzled. Okay, they're not. They don't seem to be particularly integral to these mobilizing practices. Turning to the emerging tools, when I asked the staffers and the campaigns if they used social networking tools to mobilize volunteers, in both campaigns, independently, I believe, of each other, the response was the same. People laughed at me. That's interesting, too, I think. Neither campaign used MySpace, which at the time was, according to Hitwise data, the most the social networking site with the most traffic. That's just one of the many dogs that didn't bark, though campaigns routinely make hundreds of thousands of phone calls. They don't use voice over IP either. Both campaigns had Facebook profiles, but the pattern there was the same as with the website, that the people who signed up were people who were already involved with the campaign. Many of the people who signed up were staffers, or they were staffers of other candidates in the area, or they were people who were already volunteering. So the staffers repeated the same, sort of the same, gave me the same story about Facebook profiles as they did about the campaign websites, that, yeah, sure, we have to have one. That's sort of, you know, you need to do that to be considered the cutting-edge campaign, but it's actually of relatively limited importance when it comes to mobilizing volunteers. YouTube, sort of the third tool I looked at in this case. Both campaigns shoveled their commercials onto YouTube. Both of them filmed a little bit of footage from events and posted there too. The number of views are predictably low. Neither of the campaigns did any of the things that the Obama campaign experimented somewhat with, namely sort of used YouTube to provide sort of a back channel for a core group of committed volunteers to give them a sense of what the internal machinery of the campaign looked like. There was nothing of that. There was no attempt to generate a community or to give people privileged access through YouTube as a distinct channel. It was just shovelware. So you may remember this sort of the prediction of you know, the sort of the politicians' invasion of these platforms. That prediction was made in 2006. It seems that the invasion is still being planned. It has not happened yet. At least not at that level, at the level at which I'm looking, which is relatively well-funded, but not absolutely top federal campaigns. Very well-funded, but not presidential campaigns. So turning to the last category of the three I wanted to offer, mundane tools. I think the deep involvement in campaigns of mundane tools is rather forcefully illustrated by a quote from another staffer I spoke to who was a veteran by political standards of five campaigns, and who said, this being a guy in his late 20s, "I don't know what people did before the internet." So you have, an interesting juxtaposition there between the statement, "I don't believe much in websites," and then on the other hand, the recognition that internet tools are actually integral to a lot of the work that goes on in campaigns. This is perhaps not so different from the way in which the internet has been integrated into other areas of social life. So if you think of many commercial forms, for instance, like retail and whatnot, In many areas, it's not that online shopping as such is the most important sort of form of internet involvement in that area of social life. It's more that there's been sort of a back-end revolution of the way in which logistics works and the way in which you communicate with your employers and the way in which you manage and track stuff and whatnot. And with mundane tools, both staff and volunteers, of course, regularly or even all the time use email and search for all the things we use these tools for. So they displace communication from time-consuming, occasionally cumbersome and ambiguous, interpersonal communication, face-to-face verbal stuff, and use emails instead, where you can specify details very clearly. So instead of calling the 50 people who have signed up for your volunteer canvas and telling each and every individual one of them on their voicemail if they don't pick it up or if they pick it up, you know, you sit in the crowd of campaign office and try to explain to them you have to meet at, you know, Court Road 15 at 10:15. What was it, Court Road 50? No, you sent the email. And when you have that privileged relationship of trust with people who are already involved as volunteers in the campaign, you can be reasonably sure they'll actually read that email. And many of them do, and they turn up. Another example is of search. And experience that those of you who have volunteered or worked in campaigns have probably experienced, or you may experience elsewhere too, that even within the setting, the site of the campaign office itself, the spatial boundaries are there, you have the candidate there working, you know, doing fundraising calls, you have staffers, volunteers, everyone, you know, is bussing around doing their thing, and a volunteer will turn to a staffer and ask, well, you know, what is the candidate's position on, say, you know, affordable housing? And the answer will be, why don't you look it up? Google it. So there is a displacement of that work of information sharing, for instance, onto these mundane tools. Very reasonable in a sense. But it's an interesting reply, I think, within the boundaries of the campaign office. And occasionally older folks would be a little peeved, frankly, with that answer. So that's sort of my basic argument then. In the everyday work of mobilizing people to join campaigns as volunteers, mundane tools seem to be more important than emerging or specialized tools. Now, why would that be the case? Well, first of all, volunteers use these tools already. So they don't have to be lured onto some new emerging platforms or onto a campaign website. I'm sure many of you have had this experience yourself. You know, you want to go to a conference. Lo and behold, there is a new social networking tool, Crowdwine, whatnot, that you're not on already, and you're encouraged to join that to attend the conference. And it often works, but there are transaction costs. You have to lure people onto it. That may work if you invite 50 people to a conference. If you're a congressional campaign hoping to mobilize 2,000 volunteers, many of them older folks, to do GOTV in the final days of a campaign, it may not be a cost-effective strategy. So first of all, they're already using these tools very often. It's another point on the question of luring people onto new tools. It may work if you're Barack Obama. It didn't work very well for John McCain. It didn't work very well for John Edwards either. And he had a very, very savvy tech team, very, very savvy tech team, very good people working for him. Didn't work very well for him, luring people onto those platforms. And it sure as hell don't work for mid-level congressional candidates. The people that the campaigns are trying to mobilize as volunteers are already connected with mundane extra-structures like email and the like. They use them to communicate amongst themselves, and this reinforces the mobilizational effect. So you have the distributed communication that you would imagine. The volunteers bond in the office, they swap email addresses, start coordinating amongst themselves. Okay, we're looking for a phone bank office. We're going to do it at my house. It'll be five, six people. We don't need to involve the staff in this. And they're already familiar with using them. They don't have to introduce them to how to use a particular platform. And just to reiterate the point about these categories being relative, for some groups, you could say the same things about tools that for some people are emerging, such as Facebook or even a specialized site like My Barack Obama or DeanSpace before it, that the tools that for some people are emerging or specialized might be relatively mundane to some people. So most of the people in this room would not be scared away by the prospect of trying to coordinate an event using Facebook. But for someone who's not familiar with Facebook or with My Barack Obama, there is an entry fee to be paid. There is a question of familiarizing yourself with those tools. Why not just do it in email? People tend to do that. Another point about why this might be the case, that mundane tools are more important than emerging and specialized tools, is we know from survey research that political participation is not only more common amongst the relatively more privileged strata of society, but also heavily skewed by age. And when it comes to new technology, we know similarly that the reverse sort of is the case, that early adopters tend to be younger folks. So the older folks who volunteer in campaigns are not particularly early adopters. You can see this from Pew Research and many other sources. So this sort of suggests sort of the punchline version of what I'm trying to say here, which would be sort of a, insofar as I have something I want to offer to professional organizers and volunteer organizers, is maybe to put little as emphasis on identifying the newest gadget that might be useful in mobilizing volunteers, and also forget about quaint old slogans like build it and they will come. And maybe instead thinking terms akin to the ones progressive educators talk about, meet them where they are instead. Is that a banal point? Is that a banal argument? That's sort of up to you to decide. Personally, I think that at least the attention that's given to newer tools suggests otherwise. If you think back to the months leading up to the 2008 election, all the talk of the YouTube election, for instance, maybe new technology is not always what sociologists would call master status traits that define the kernel of events. Maybe there are more modular elements added to existing events, at least sometimes. At least it didn't seem to materialize the YouTube election. More importantly, I think the uneven impact of new technologies suggests that case studies of what particular categories of tools are most important in a particular area are still relevant. If you look at a sector like finance, for instance, arguably specialized tools have been much more important and integral to the practice pursued there than mundane tools or emerging tools. I mean, you all know the proprietary models that derivative traders used for computerized trading. And if you think of emerging tools, they continue to be absolutely central and crucial to understand many new and distinct communities of innovators and early adopters. So this is not an argument that emerging tools are irrelevant as such at all. It's only when it comes to mobilizing practices that seem empirically to be of relatively limited importance, at least in the cases that I think of as ordinary but well-funded and competitive political campaigns in the U.S. So should this then be taken to mean that emerging and specialized tools don't matter at all in politics? Far from it. Emerging tools are used for social and networking purposes among staffers and professionals. If you want to be a consultant or work as a political staffer, you better be on those tools, that's for sure. And they're also important for viral marketing, and there have been very important and impressive cases of that. Specialized tools, I think, are more interesting when it comes to mobilizing practices, and perhaps more important, even if they aren't particularly important for the act of mobilization itself. My research suggests that their primary purposes are control and management and measurement. So even if campaign websites are accompanied by the newly popular rhetoric of participation, you will always see the action center, you know, come take part, be part of the campaign, all of that. And there certainly is an ethos of this emerging, and there are many organizers who feel very strongly about this. But the actual practical implications of the specialized tools, the dedicated solutions that are adopted by campaigns, is primarily to control, measure, and manage volunteer involvement. And I think there are some examples, even with cutting-edge examples like the My Barack Obama site, in the two campaigns I did my research in, staffers would routinely be horrified when they realized that volunteers could set up their own events for their own purposes. How dare they? How dare they make calls into Pennsylvania from our competitive congressional district? Don't they realize that he is ahead and that we are teetering on the brink? How dare they? And they would routinely try not only to reframe these events, but actually try to get them off the site or sabotage and send someone there with different scripts. There's a real power struggle sometimes going on between these communities. And in these struggles, the specialized tools are tools that the staffers try to use to manage and control volunteers who do not, for a variety of different reasons, do not share their instrumental goals. So I think this needs to be recognized. And so in summary, so that's where I stand. The question is, what tools are most important for mobilizing practices? My argument is, I think mundane tools like email and search are. I think they're most important because they're already there, because they allow for distributed communication, and they're familiar to people who in politics are mainly older, the people who are getting involved. Why is that important? Well, I think that's important because it means that campaigns are highly dependent on the built information infrastructure or exostructure. They are highly dependent on tools that are not under their control when it comes to mobilizing volunteers, and hence they turn to specialized tools to try to ensure control. There is a very strong command and control mentality and approach within the staff community. So that is sort of the end line. The mundane tools are facilitating, in this case, for collaboration, which is an integral element of trying to mobilize people to volunteer for campaigns. And they're a counterbalance in practice by specialized tools meant to facilitate control from staffers. Thank you.
So if the economy is moving away from command and control to remote controls and individual choice and total freedom of choice, why are the elected officials trying to do command and control on the volunteers and like blowing up all their enthusiasm? Or another way of putting it is, why are they trying to build things from scratch when everybody knows that there's more emotion in an old hit song than in the latest song that people are hearing for the first time that's a genre they don't even like? Just wondering.
Yeah. No, those are great questions. First question first, about the command and control that still seems to be sort of the predominant mindset in the professional community in politics. I'm most familiar with how this plays out in the Democratic professional community. So if anyone has inside information about what this looks like from a Republican point of view, I would be very interested in hearing that. Over the last roughly 10 years, there's been an increased attention paid to the power of personalized political communication, so which came out of labor research and research from Yale about the impact of volunteer contact. And there is a very explicit recognition that the most effective volunteer mobilizations are dependent on treating people as stakeholders, as partners, and not as the bottom part of a hierarchy. Any community organizer knows that. Any labor organizer knows that. Most political organizers knows it too. Now, in campaigns, that clashes with a very different mindset that comes out of a broadcast environment, which is on message, staying on message, a control mindset, which has very, very reasonable motivations in that environment. You don't want a gaffe, basically. And there is this fear that a lazy journalist will go and interview one of your volunteers, and that volunteer will say, "Well, you know, Sarah Palin, you know, she's dumb, you know, she is, you know, whatever you can imagine it," and then it'll run on Fox News, and you'll have to deal with it. Or, you know, Barack Obama is not a real American, whatnot. So I think that control mindset is inherited. And just to come with a causal sort of a hint at a causal element behind that. If you look at the status hierarchies and professional career paths of political professionals, even if this is changing as we speak, towards increased emphasis in new media and on organizing and increased recognition of its importance, the money and the professional prestige is still to be found as a communications consultant or as a policy consultant or a fundraising consultant. It's not to be found in the field. So it's low status work. They're not the decision makers in campaigns typically. It's very rare for campaign managers to come out of field. So that's the first question. The second question, why they build things from scratch, that's a trickier one. I don't have a clear answer. I would be interested to hear people's opinions on that. I think my only intuition would be that I think that's a very that's sort of a gut reaction in a control environment, is you want to build your own tools. Because you want to know what they're like, and you want to understand how they work, and don't really understand all this stuff that's floating out there, and for good reasons. There is not so much money to be made in politics, especially when you don't move down from the presidential level. There are many good techies working in politics, but there are also a lot of people who are not necessarily the best programmers around. I mean, let's.
Maybe also, right? Consultants. If you sell people on your proprietary tool,
exactly, you make money,
and you're the expert at that. Mm-hmm. So even the candidate can't out expert you at your own tool.
Yep,
maybe.
Absolutely, no, there's a black box.
Centralization. I mean, can you maybe analyze why you think Obama was able to use in terms of fundraising, though it's not the best for most of the people supporting, would you say that emails could do similar, or maybe in terms of financial, because automation or give $5, whatever it is asking?
Can you see how that could be analyzed in terms of in different categories of volunteers, or would you put in the same category, or is there just simply a correlation or intersection with that? How would you analyze
that? I mean, I'd be more than happy to take a stab at it. It comes with the proviso that I'm not an expert on fundraising in politics. My sense is that the differences are these. Fundraising is an absolutely crucial and high-prestige area in professional political work. and it's often the first thing that a campaign gets started on. So they have more time to learn from their mistakes. Also, the output is easier to measure, which means that you can do all the stuff that the Obama campaign did and that people have done a lot with in political fundraising. You can have real-time measurement of your effect. So you can do real-time experiments with how you phrase an email, what is the response rate and whatnot, which is extremely, when you have a large email list, this is very powerful that you can do real-time experiments and learn from that. It's much harder when it comes to volunteer mobilization. I think MoveOn is doing some work in that area, but it's the hard data, at least the publicly available hard data in that area, is nowhere near in qualities of the hard data and when it comes to fundraising.
Maybe on the model that you have.
The
emerging tools essentially are mundane tools in waiting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And
or they could go away, but yeah.
Or they could go away, right?
Uh-huh.
What's that?
Most of them probably will.
Yeah.
Right? In that they're.
Yeah, I mean, I think the option is either they go away or they become mundane. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, to some degree that follows a sort of a traditional life cycle of
mm-hmm.
things tend to evolve. And maybe there's a 2x2 as well there, right? Which is sort of the time scale of how things go from being emerging to mundane. And then on the other side, there's a notion of complexity, right? And so if you look at, part of this is in the nature of the activity. It's about being quick and mobilizing fast. And so if you think of a second axis that has to do with complexity,
mm-hmm.
your specialized tools tend to be bigger and more complex. But even within the concept of specialized tools, you've got specialized tools that are very well established. So you look at financial tools, ERP systems are well understood at this point. On the other end, you've got, more sort of emerging CRM concepts and other things that are equally specialized, complex, but still less understood. And that may be sort of another way to think about this. The question also is, have you ever looked at instant message and texting in the context?
Okay, that's a lot to rip into there. That's really helpful. I'd like to, if there are anybody else who have comments on the idea of the typology, I would love to have them either now or later, because that's really the crux of, that's obvious to everyone. If that doesn't work, there is no argument. Then it's just sort of a description of what's going on. This is very helpful. I absolutely agree with the first part of it, that in a sense American tools become mundane tools for some community at some point in time. And I would also add to it that I think the biggest sort of structural problem I have with my own typology, the tripartite division, is that whereas the mundane emerging part makes some sense to me as a continuum, the specialized is sort of a different category in a sense. Here is the reason why I'm a little reluctant to think in terms of complexity. I would say that the mundane tools are very often much more complex than many of the specialized tools. Because the specialized tools in politics, at least many of them, are not particularly, I'm not a computer programmer at all, but what I know from people who are not particularly sophisticated. The My Barack Obama site is certainly not more sophisticated than Facebook, that's for sure. And the many of the other applications used are even less sophisticated. They're very old pieces of software often. It's true that in other areas of life they are very often very sophisticated, but I'm not sure that's the case in politics necessarily. So that's sort of the reason I've been a little reluctant to jump onto that. So on the instant messaging and the texting, I have some field notes on instant messaging. There are very few, so I should go back and look at that. My overall sense is that they are kind of like Facebook and MySpace in that the campaigns rarely use them particularly aggressively or systematically vis-a-vis volunteers, but the staffers use them a lot amongst themselves. So that's sort of the general check of thing. Texting, I don't have any data on that. I would love to see it. I know there are many people working on it. That's fascinating. It's really a very interesting area, but I don't have any data on it. So.
There isn't, in, at least in the case of Obama campaign or any other for that matter, that they're using customized tools worse than using, Facebook, is because it keeps, once person is there, they sort of stay there instead of getting distracted by all the other things that are available on Facebook.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that's sort of a quip that a lot of organizers repeat all the time, is that the hardest thing is to get people in the door the first time, and then it's about keeping them. So they're very concerned about attrition rates, and a lot of these tools are used less in the recruitment phase, but more in terms of maintaining relations with people who have already volunteered once and trying to coach them to come again. The customer relationship management tools and a lot of the data that is harvested from the specialized tools is the back end of that, the information that they use to monitor people's behavior, and then the emails is the most common tool, and tons of phone calls, parties, whatnot, are the other tools that they use to maintain people's involvement. Which, by the way, has an interesting and reinforcing effect that we've seen a lot in politics, that though it's occasionally broken, which is this increasing rarefication, where people do use historical data to target ever more narrowly. So you have an existing population of people who have identified as potential volunteers. You call through the list, you recruit 10% of them. Those 10% show up the first time. 50% of them drop out. You know, those 50% then get another notch in the book, and the next time a campaign comes along, they're even more likely to be targeted for volunteer recruitments, whereas the people who did not respond well get sort of a minus in the margin and are less likely to be contacted. So there's sort of an interesting cycle going on there, which is only occasionally broken, which is sort of a lock-in problem that a lot of campaigns struggle with due to time pressure and resource limitations.
Just to comment on what you just mentioned, I think part of the beauty of the Obama website is that it was almost an exact replica of their website, and they were able to do absolutely everything that you could do on the Obama website. Sign up for things, find your voting booth. I believe that the volunteers could sign up front, and all the data was likewise captured. So it was essentially like they had built this micro page where they could get everything they needed on the back end, and nobody had, because that's the one thing about Facebook, is that you're on Facebook, no one wants to leave Facebook. And they were able to do everything they needed to without anybody leaving.
That's a very important point. I wanted to add that to my response to the first question, that's the same reason that the Dean campaign went off Meetup in the 2004 primary eventually, is that Meetup doesn't share its data with the clients, and the campaigns need the data for fundraising purposes and for other purposes. I want to say one thing about the Obama campaign, which is really, really crucial to keep in mind when one is trying to generalize, to draw sort of generalized conclusions about the use of new technology in politics, is it helps a lot to have an extremely charismatic candidate. It helps a lot to have $750 million. And most political campaigns have neither an extremely charismatic candidate nor $750 million. So it's very important to appreciate how groundbreaking that campaign was in a number of ways, but it is equally important to appreciate why they could. And on the tech side, if you're interested in this, you should check out the Democratic National Committee's site, Party Builder, which was also designed by Blue State Digital, and was when the Obama campaign first launched My Barack Obama, that site was essentially identical with Party Builder. The interface was slightly different, the design was slightly different, but the basic structure was the same. Party Builder was, I shouldn't say this on record, if this was not being recorded, I would say that Party Builder was an abject failure in terms of achieving the goals, the purposes it was meant to achieve, and I think many people who are involved in it would agree, and obviously the My Barack Obama site was not. So there are interesting differences there that have little to do with technology, arguably.
And it strikes me that CRM and fundraising both have collected demographic and historical data around are you going to buy, are you going to spend, whereas at least in the door-to-door, the focus was on are the curtains open, is there a political sign in the yard, is there a tricycle in the yard, the same house with the same demographics might be a lot more open to knock on the door or not knock on the door. And those attributes of the people who volunteer or the people who might respond to a doorbell knock are probably not in the Amazon database or the other voter databases or whatever. Did they vote? Yes, but not the street conditions of is this going to be worth your time to knock on this door?
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's absolutely true. And I think that I mean, this is really something that both parties have been working very hard to catch up on. I mean, this is something that should always be kept in mind when people talk about how high-tech politics has become, is to try to think about it comparatively. It may actually be a lot less high-tech than retail is in many ways, and the data available is maybe much less sophisticated and much less rigorously collected. And both parties are struggling very hard to overcome that problem. That's also why you see a lot of bureaucratic maneuvering to try to ensure standardized technologies and whatnot. The voter activation network is is a breakthrough, it seems, in this regard, and that's, I think, is the first time that the Democratic Party has successfully maintained both managed to build a useful tool and actually make basically everyone use it, whereas the Republican Party has done this for more than 10 years by now with Voter World. So their historical data is, I hear, more detailed and better, whereas the Democratic data is not quite as quite up there yet. But it's a changing field every day. So I think Lagman is calling time, and I'd love more questions and comments, but I think our host should call it. Thank you, everyone, for coming.